Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Well, thank you for joining us for episode 27 of Pepperdine People. I'm Jim Prieger, professor of economics at the School of Public Policy, and today I'm joined by Jerry Ellig. Jerry is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University in Virginia. And today we're going to be chatting about regulation, one of Jerry Ellig's specialties. And Jerry, let's just start with the general question of what are some of the problems with how regulation currently works in D.C.?
Well, I think the biggest single problem with regulation in Washington is a really big picture thing, which is that way too much of the debate occurs in terms of broad values and symbolism rather than a focus on what is this regulation actually going to accomplish, what is the evidence we have that it will accomplish this, and then, you know, what are the not so good effects, what are the costs associated with it, and what's the evidence about that. A lot of people in Washington, though, want to debate regulation in terms of simply values and intentions, so that if you oppose this regulation, then you must be against a safer environment, or you must be against homeland security. Or in fact, if you say anything negative about this regulation, then you must be against the intention of the regulation. Where in reality, you know, academics like us, we like to ask rude questions about everything to try to find out, do we really understand what we're doing? And if you ask questions that are focused on, do we really understand what we're doing, sometimes you get accused of having bad ethics and values.
Well, we have an administration in place that has at least stated that it wants to put more weight on evidence in things like public policy. Have you seen the role of evidence and a more formal approach to policy change over the years in D.C.?
Well, most recently with the Obama administration, I think it's too early to tell. Certainly the kinds of things the administration has said about focusing on evidence, focusing on analysis of the outcomes of government actions, is a good and positive thing. And if that is applied more consistently to regulation, that would be great. Honestly, as that applies to regulation, it's really too early to tell because we're in the end of the president's first year. And so it takes a long time to turn a battleship in Washington. So whether this is really going to affect how regulation is analyzed and adopted, we'll have to wait and see.
On the subject of evidence, can you say a little bit about what cost-benefit analysis is and how it should or is being used?
I actually prefer the term regulatory analysis, which is the term that's used in the executive order that tells federal agencies what kind of analysis they have to do of regulations. The reason I prefer that term is regulatory analysis starts with asking, what kind of problem are you trying to solve? Without making a judgment about what's the appropriate solution, but you start with asking, what kind of problem are we trying to solve? What caused the problem? What's the nature of the problem? Then you ask, what are the alternative ways of dealing with this problem, whether it's federal regulation, state regulation, maybe fixing previous federal regulations that created incentives to cause some kind of problem, maybe defining property rights better so that people can work out their problems on their own. There could be a very broad range of options considered for solving a lot of problems that regulations are supposed to solve. And then after we know what the options are, we get into the issue of costs and benefits. What are the good things that we hope will happen as a result of the regulation? And then what are some of the bad things or the costs? What do we have to give up in order to get the good things? But I think the analysis of the costs and benefits has to come after we've really understood what kind of problem we're trying to solve and what are all the possible options on the table. And that's where the real benefit of the approach comes in, because it helps us understand the consequences of different ways of trying to solve a problem. And really it boils down to, you know, weighing the pros and cons of different solutions.
One thing that I hear as an economist, particularly from students who are first being introduced to these notions sometimes, is that economists take far too narrow a view of what benefits might be and the notion that we try to quantify everything that we can. Do you have any thoughts on how much we can do with a purely regulatory analysis approach?
Well, since I'm an economist, let me give you an on the one hand and an on the other hand. On the one hand, I think that the issue of quantifying benefits or costs, and especially putting money values on these things, we have to approach it with a lot of humility, a lot of recognition that there are tremendous uncertainties out there, and we really need to understand that there are a range of possible results that might come out of the calculations. So I am not a big believer in the idea that we should automate regulatory decisions by calculating costs, calculating benefits, and then saying, well, regulate if the benefits exceed the costs, don't regulate if the costs exceed the benefits. I think the cost and benefit information is useful and important information for decision makers to have. For example, yesterday I flew here from Washington, flew to into LAX from Washington, D.C., and of course had to have show up at the airport a certain amount of time ahead of time in order to be have all of my stuff checked, and I couldn't have any kinds of fluids in my luggage that was more than a couple ounces if I was carrying it on. And, you know, when the federal government issues regulations like that, I think it's very important, and I think the public has a right to know, how much safer are we because of that regulation? How much longer are we going to have to spend in line at the airport because of that regulation? And I would like the people making those decisions in the federal government, I would like to know that they have considered those things before deciding what to do, instead of just saying, well, this will probably increase security, so let's go ahead and do it. That's an approach, again, that goes back to the making decisions based on intentions and values rather than on an understanding of how much are we accomplishing and how much do we give up in order to do it.
You mentioned that regulatory analysis is something that shows up in an executive order. And my understanding is that a series of presidents, Republican and Democrat, over the years have issued such executive orders regarding particular ways to approach regulation. In that sense, they seem to be approaching things from the same point of view. But can you point out some of the party differences that might show up with different approaches toward regulation or the different mindset that might distinguish a Democrat from a Republican inside the Beltway?
Oh, sure. Let me mention some of the commonalities first, because you're right. Review of regulations by someone at the White House, in the Office of Management and Budget, has really happened in every administration since President Nixon. The sort of modern version of the executive order laying out what agencies had to do and how their regulations would be reviewed and establishing the White House's ability to tell an agency, no, you can't issue that regulation because you haven't analyzed it well enough, or it's not consistent with administration policy or whatever. That kind of thing really dates back to President Reagan. It was continued under President Bush. President Clinton rewrote the executive order in various ways, but didn't make huge changes to it. And then our past President Bush and also President Obama currently are operating under that same executive order. President Obama has asked for public comments on how to revise it, so there's some kind of revision of it in the works. So it has the idea that the president and the folks he appoints can review regulations issued by agencies has a long history. Different administrations have administered it maybe a bit differently. I think in general, Republican administrations tend to emphasize the idea that the Office of Management and Budget, or actually an office within that office called the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, is kind of a gatekeeper that is checking the federal agency's work, checking the regulations, and telling them, wait a minute, no, you can't do that. And maybe it's because it's contrary to administration policy. Maybe it's because some other federal agency has an objection to it, because part of what they do is review regulations and coordinate this process where agencies look at each other's regulations to make sure that, say, the Commerce Department isn't doing something that's going to undermine what Homeland Security is trying to do. So in that sense, Republicans have tended to treat that process as a little more like a gatekeeping function. In Democratic administrations, at least if you listen to what people say, they're maybe a little more willing to defer to agencies' judgment on what should be done. But the oversight role is pretty important regardless.
On the subject of politics, one of the accepted messages in the media today appears to be with regard to the global financial crisis that economic deregulation, usually undefined, was a big part of the problem that led us to the problems that we have. Do you want to comment just a bit first on what sort of economic deregulation does it make sense to really think about as being related to this crisis?
Oh, definitely. I think we have to distinguish between two types of economic deregulation. There was a wave of economic deregulation in the late 1970s and early 1980s, much of it set in motion by President Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy on transportation and energy industries, natural gas, telecommunications, airlines, trucking, railroads, and pretty much all of the scholarly studies from folks, whether the researchers are regarded as left, right, center, Republican, Democrat. The best research on this has actually come out of the Brookings Institution in Washington, and pretty much all of the research finds huge consumer benefits from this type of deregulation of transportation and energy that occurred in the 1970s and the 1980s. We're talking, if you update the figures to reflect the current value of the dollar and inflation, we're talking benefits for consumers anywhere between, you know, $60 to $100 billion a year. Mm. That economic deregulation is not disappearing, and nobody seriously suggests that we go backward on that. The kind of economic deregulation that people talk about leading to the financial crisis is possibly deregulation in the financial services industry, but it's difficult for anybody to point to a specific deregulatory event. Some people point to the passage of the Glass-Steagall Act, which basically allowed New York-type investment banks, which help underwrite securities. It allowed them to also be commercial banks, broke down the barriers between banking and insurance. But letting different financial services companies get into each other's markets didn't really have any effect on the kind of risks that led to the financial crisis. The fundamental question we have to answer in order to understand the financial crisis is this, and I can't take credit for it. My colleague at George Mason University, Russ Roberts, has written and talked about this a lot. We have to understand, why is it that people who were taking big risks with other people's money were continually able to borrow? I mean, you can understand if I'm taking a big risk with your money, you can understand why I take the risk because I could benefit from it and I don't have much skin in the game. But why is it that you keep lending to me even though I'm taking really big risks? And most of the financial entities that were out there making big risks were financial entities that expected to get bailed out somehow by the federal government. And there was precedent for this. For example, in the early 1980s, we had similar types of problems with savings and loans in California, in Texas, in the Southwest. They were overextended. A lot of savings and loans were nearly insolvent because of the crash in real estate prices in California and Texas, partly as a result of the end of the energy boom in Texas. So we had a lot of savings and loans that were worth very little, but the deposits were guaranteed by the federal government. That set up a situation where the owners of the savings and loans could gamble with depositors' money. If the gamble paid off, the owner of the savings and loan would profit tremendously. If the gamble didn't pay off, the government would shut down the savings and loan, the depositors would get their money back, and the owners of the saving loan would lose the little bit of equity that they had invested. So it's a great game to be in if you want a savings and loan, want to have a savings and loan and take gambles. That's the same kind of problem that was occurring in our financial crisis, whether it was the Wall Street investment firms that were very heavily leveraged and basically borrowing money short-term in order to take long-term positions in various kinds of products that were linked to mortgages. That was a big chunk of it. Whether it was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buying mortgages from the folks who had originated the mortgages, packaging those mortgages, selling them to investors with an implicit federal guarantee that the federal government would backstop it if the mortgages defaulted. So an awful lot of this can be traced back to what economists refer to as moral hazard, the risk that people will engage in kind of stupid behavior when you tell them you don't have to bear the consequences of your behavior, but you could profit if it pays off.
But is it fair to say that the stupid behavior is actually a rational response given the protections and the fact that they won't have to bear the cost of their actions rather than some behavioral story of investors just didn't know what was going on and what they were doing?
Yeah, I don't think investors all of a sudden got wild and crazy and started ignoring reality. Although, I mean, there may be something to the idea that, you know, once a bubble gets going, you know, people invest a little and it seems to pay off. So then they invest a little more and it seems to pay off. And you make decisions based on your recent experience. So there may have been some distortion along those lines. But I think the biggest single distortion was kind of what got the problem started and got the ball rolling, which was the likelihood that if certain financial entities made big bets on certain investments that didn't pay off, that you and I would end up picking up the tab for it and pay off some of that.
Yeah, which we now are. As we bring things to a close here, could you just say something about what some of the trends there are that you see in future regulation in D.C.? And maybe if you can just comment a bit, do you see us headed in the right direction at the moment?
Well, it depends on how you define the right direction. Let me just describe sort of factually what I see happening, and we'll let the listeners judge whether they think this is the right direction or not. One big trend that we've had over the past several decades is this decline in economic regulation that I mentioned in industries like transportation and energy and telecommunications and old-fashioned telephone service anyway. And it's doubtful that much of that is going to be reversed. And the evidence seems to show that that produced big benefits for consumers. Another trend, big trend, though, is an increase in what's referred to as social regulation. That is regulation that's focused on the environment, on health and safety, on security, on civil rights, those kind of things. If you look at the trends in social regulation, you find a gradual increase since World War II, a very rapid increase under President Nixon through the end of President Carter, a bit of a drop under President Reagan, and then a resumption of a gradual climb under the first President Bush and President Clinton. Then a big spike under George W. Bush, largely fueled by a big increase in security regulation and security-related activity. That leads to the third trend, which is increased Homeland Security regulation. If you look at regulatory spending by the federal government or you look at the number of employees who are engaged in regulation in the federal government, you find right after 2001 this giant jump. And it was the federalization of the airport screening workforce who previously had been private contractors working for airlines. And after 9/11, the federal government took over airport screening. And then after that big jump, you still find security spending and security regulation continuing to climb. If you look at the budget projections from the Obama administration, it appears that the Obama administration is assuming that at least the expenditures on security regulation and the number of personnel will continue to increase, but at a slower rate than it did under President Bush. So it looks like increasing security regulation is with us to stay. Fourth big trend is something called midnight regulation. And a number of my colleagues at the Mercatus Center have written a great deal about this. This is the tendency for all kinds of presidential administrations, Republican or Democrat, to concentrate regulatory activity in the last quarter at the end of the president's term. And this is particularly pronounced at the end of eight years of a presidential term when the president's a lame duck, or when the presidency is switching parties. So, for example, you had this kind of midnight regulation. The really big one was at the end of the Carter administration when Ronald Reagan was coming in. You didn't get much midnight regulation with Ronald Reagan, interestingly. But then you do see this phenomenon with George Herbert Walker Bush when he was a lame duck and presidency was going to be turned over to President Clinton. You see it under Clinton. You see it under George W. Bush. Although at the end of George W. Bush's term, it was moderated somewhat. So it wasn't as bad as under some of the previous presidents. Finally, the big trend number five, we've already kind of talked about it, which is a trend toward increasing regulation in the financial industry in response to the financial crisis. And there's an important thing we ought to keep in mind when we talk about increasing regulation in the financial industry. And that is this, that some of the regulation people will propose is going to be narrowly focused on solving problems that they think contributed to the crisis, like regulation of credit default swaps, which were contracts that were attempts to provide insurance against the possibility that people who hold mortgages would experience defaults. This proposal to let the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation liquidate big financial firms that are in trouble. I'm not saying if it's a good idea or a bad idea, but some of this financial regulation is focused on things that people think contributed to the crisis. There's other financial regulation that's going to be gratuitous in the sense that it has very little to do with the financial crisis, but the financial crisis was a good excuse to do stuff that people wanted to do anyway. This talk about creating a version of the Consumer Financial Product Safety Commission that's going to evaluate financial products offered to consumers and give them some idea of which ones are safer and which ones are not safer. Irrespective of the fact that different products and services are probably more appropriate or more risky for different kinds of consumers. For some consumers, a 30-year fixed rate mortgage is the great thing. For other consumers, that's actually a ridiculously risky thing. I mean, if you plan to move in the next 5 years, an adjustable rate mortgage is probably the better thing. But anyway, this proposed commission is supposed to evaluate these things and tell us all what's more risky and what's less risky. Yeah, that's something that people wanted to do anyway and had been floating around for a long time before there ever was a financial crisis. New regulations on credit card companies. If you've read your credit card bills and the accompanying stuff in the envelope recently, there are all kinds of changes in the terms of your credit card agreements, some of which seem to lower your costs, others increase your costs. Those ideas had been floating around for a long time. The financial crisis just provided an excuse to push that stuff through. So some of the new financial regulation might have something to do with causes of the financial crisis. Other financial regulation is going to happen because, well, people don't like financial firms now, so it's possible to ram stuff through that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
It seems to show up in more than one venue inside the Beltway. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been very interesting talking with you about regulation, and I guess we'll all find out together what the future holds.
And thank you. It was a pleasure.